I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way.
Hello, you're listening to the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, one of the co-producers of the show. Today's show is about an exhibit about incarceration currently on display in Catskill, New York. I spoke with Molly Stinchfield, one of the curators of the exhibit.
I'm Molly Stinchfield. I'm the visual arts director at Greene County Council on the Arts in Catskill. We do several things. Greene County Council on the Arts has 12 visual arts shows a year in our two galleries on our in our two-story building on Main Street. We thought it would be really engaging to direct this conversation into how our communities are engaging with the prisons and jails that are active in Greene and Columbia counties. In Greene County, for example, the prisons and jails are some of the largest middle-class employers. So we have a lot of people who work in the prisons. We have a lot of people who have been in the prisons, people who have had family members in prisons and county jails. So it's a very pressing issue for us. I mean, all of us living in Greene and Columbia County drive by the prisons and jails all the time. Whether or not we choose to acknowledge that they're there is another issue. And so we wanted to bring some of those issues into the forefront of communities as a way to connect the people who are thinking about these issues so that they can all talk to each other and destigmatize some of the issues of shame surrounding being incarcerated from all sides, and as a way for people who don't think about these issues as much to interact with their neighbors and talk about these issues in a safe way that, you know, doesn't involve people screaming at them and forcing their agendas down their throat, and just a way for neighbors to come together and talk about the way that these issues affect them. When you walk in the first floor gallery, it doesn't really feel like an art show in the same way that when you walk into a museum or a gallery space, it's usually white walls with artwork hanging with a lot of space in between each piece. When you walk in, it feels like you're walking into a different space entirely. It's like it's something that is actually kind of hard to describe. But when you walk in, the first thing you see on the right is a length from the window all the way almost to the back of the gallery of these cardboard birds that are painted on top of this giant swath of brown paper that goes from across the entire wall all the way down to the floor, several feet out on the floor. And there are black bars painted on all of the pieces of brown paper. And the birds are taped up. There's words written all over the whole entire installation. And there's orange netting that cascades all over the whole thing that binds some of the birds to the space. So some of the birds are caught in boxes, there are crates that they're stuck in, some of them are flying on the wall, but they have these these words swirling around them and these messages that say things like the new Jim Crow and Black Lives Matter and driving while black and these different kinds of images and words that evoke a lot of resonance in our current political situation and our current criminal justice situation. And that's an installation by Henrietta Mantooth. And she is also having a dancer, Andre Noel, who was incarcerated for several years from the time he was 17. He learned modern dance in prison, and he's going to be doing a performance on that installation. So that's what's on the right. And then in the back of the installation, the back of the room is an installation by Dee Dee Halleck and Claudia McNulty, and that is actually a recreated classroom from the 1970s where she was working with boys who were incarcerated at the Otisville School for Boys, and she had been teaching them film and photography skills in the 1970s, so it's actually a direct recreation of that classroom.
I had the opportunity to attend the exhibit and see the displays, including the films made by Dee Dee Halleck. Prison Voices Project co-producer Emily Truitt interviewed Halleck about her work. We begin with some of the sounds from the exhibit and an excerpt from one of the films that Dee Dee Halleck made.
I need help in my stomach, and I die. You know, I say I'm dead now, but still, and all, I'm still thinking. I'm still thinking of this quiet sleep. What can I do? Why? Why did I do this? Every time I think about it, you know, like I get like shook up inside because as I'm here, you know.
This project grew out of my going through my piles and piles of negatives, photographs, films, and papers, mostly papers. But and I found 4,000 negatives that were taken at Otisville School for Boys. I taught there from like 1967 to 1973, and I applied first. I was teaching arts and crafts, and then I applied for a job teaching film. And I got my own funding. I got a Title I grant for it was federal aid to special communities or something. So we were able to buy a Bolex camera and some Super 8 cameras and film and a still camera, and we were able to actually pay for the development and enlargement of the photographs. So the kids didn't have a dark room, but they did a lot of photography, and I suddenly came on these photographs and thought, well, I should digitize them. And I found someone to help me digitize them, and I started looking at them, and I, my God, these are really great photos. So I originally just wanted to do a show of the still photographs. And Tracy Hewling, who works with an organization called Prison Public Memory Project, knew about the photographs and also knew about the films and said, well, why don't we do an do an installation? And so she suggested this woman, Claudia McNulty, who's a local artist who is just terrific. I mean, she's an excellent artist. I really like her paintings and the work that she's done installation-wise. And for whatever reason, she very generously agreed to help with this installation, which I could never have done it without her. And she actually... the idea was to recreate the room in which my film class met, and the kids the guys who were from 14 to 17, they painted the room themselves and then painted graffiti in it. So they painted the whole thing black, even the windows. They painted over the windows black. And
were they making a dark room?
No, they weren't making a dark room. They said they did. They hated the location. They were mostly city kids, and they did not like being up in the country, even though we had a beautiful view out the window. I said, oh, but why are you painting the window? It's so pretty out there. And they said, we don't like it. When we come to your class, we want to feel like we're in the city. We're in back home in the city. And so that's what they did, and I let them do it. And they also painted a big white screen to show their films. And Claudia has reconstructed that. And although the original screen was much bigger, and we used to show films there, I would check out films from the New York Public Library and screen them there, and also they would show their own films over and over again. So I have a lot of prints of their films, and some of which are very scratched. But I was able recently to preserve them. There's a new way of preserving 16mm film, which is to scan each frame. The guys who made the films were very particular as to which records go with which scenes, and there are some really great James Brown and Staple Singers, and a lot of very interesting old sounds from the 60s and 70s, even The Doors.
Yeah.
So.
Did they have experience with filmmaking or any kind of art or music or?
Well, some of them had been in institutions before. There was an institution for younger kids called Highland, which was near New Paltz, and there was one called Warwick, which is near Warwick, New York. And there were a number of students who had been in institutions all their lives, and that pretty much was about the only place they had had any exposure to doing art. And so some of them had this kind of ability to paint or even talk about art. They'd had some art teachers, but probably more than the average kid has going to public school nowadays, which seems to be like they've cut out all the art classes. So but I tried to make the environment in the room as rich in terms of cultural exposure as I could. So I brought in a lot of books, books about the history of art, books about films, and we looked at a lot of films. So, for example, there's a beautiful film, Rembrandt, Painter of Man, which is a by a wonderful Dutch filmmaker, Bert Hanstra, and I showed them that. It's an amazing film. And also, Shirley Clarke did a film about Robert Frost. There was another. These are all like these library films. There were, in the old days, the libraries had film administrators who would choose films to go to their collection, and they would purchase them. And actually, it was a way a number of independent filmmakers were able to make their living.
Was it hard to get this class into the correctional facility, or were they open to you doing this?
Well, we're talking like 67, 68, 69. There was a lot of changes going on, and people felt there was a kind of openness to trying new things. And I must say, there was a very different mood in terms of youth facilities. At the time, I hated it. I felt it was, the institution, I felt it was like a gulag. And I felt like I always tried to get the kids off campus. Like we made films and then we'd show them at a high school or at the local Kiwanis Club or the library. We traveled all around because I felt every minute they were out of that institution was positive and may have helped their rehabilitation. But the school itself was very committed to rehabilitation, and a lot of the faculty at the school were really cared about the kids. I mean, they had to, because I think the pay was lower than in the regular public schools, and they were people who had come there for a reason, and that reason was they felt they could really make a difference in people's lives. And there was an attempt to really have more racially diverse than you would get in public schools. So there were African Americans on the faculty, which in those days was unusual.
What do you think about film as a medium for, like, what did film offer those kids as a art medium that other art mediums don't offer?
Well, you know, it's hard to, you know, nowadays everybody has their iPhone and can shoot video or take photographs, and so it's much more common. In those days, it was the kids felt very interested in it. But, you know, their main art form was music. They knew all the songs very well. They knew every word of every song, and it meant a whole lot to them. And so, in a way, mostly the films, I think, are visual references to this very deep connection they felt to that music, which they would listen a lot in their dorms, and they had collected stuff on the street or wherever they got their 45s. That was the medium, was 45s. Their 45s were so used, you couldn't read the labels, but they knew just by a little corner of, you know, color on it, which one was which and which side had this. I was very impressed with just how deeply felt that musical culture was in their lives, meant a lot. And so what they loved mostly about, because we didn't have sync sound, we just had a Bolex, which makes a lot of noise when you shoot it.
Do you think some of the storylines are autobiographical?
Oh, for sure. They're, or just trying to express how they feel. There's one, I don't know if you saw the on-campus one, but it was a student opens a door into a classroom, and the professor is writing in some unknown language. And a lot of these kids would, when they went to school, not necessarily at Otisville, but in other schools, they weren't used to certain kinds of language, and school was a foreign territory for them. So I think this kid really expressed that visually very well. Yeah. One of the films is called Get on the Good Foot, and it's about the story of what it's like to get to Otisville and to get your clothing issued. Mm-hmm. And the kids, they really wanted to shoot in the clothing center, because there were two women who work in the clothing center.
I saw the film, yeah.
And they give them candy. Like, it was near Halloween, and they had some trick-or-treat candy or something. But when we shot it, it wasn't Halloween. And they had to go, and we had to buy that candy, because they remember that so well, that when they went in to get their state clothes, these two sort of grandmother-type women gave them candy, and they wanted to reproduce that.
Yeah.
And so we bought candy corn, and then they show that. And they lingered on these women. It's a long scene, but partly is that was the only women they'd seen in their whole time at Otisville. And me. So I felt that deprivation, and that's one reason I ended up we're often taking them to Middletown, which was the nearest city sort of town, and they met a bunch of girls, and then they would have pen pals and write to the girls, and some of them, two of them even ended up living in Middletown. So,
what do you want people to get out of this installation that is being shown? What do you want the viewer to feel or see or understand in any way?
Well, one thing is to realize that, you know, that how much talent and passion these kids have, and that even though they had done, you know, they were in trouble, quote unquote, they were also you know, human beings who had real needs and concerns, and that they were really creative, that they were able, I mean, to me, every person is able to be, every human being can be creative and has that potential.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project. I'm Alexandra Cox, one of the co-producers of the show. Curator Molly Stinchfield of the Greene County Council of the Arts describes the rest of the exhibit.
There's a piece by, another piece by Claudia McNulty that has a, it has doors, and on the inside of the doors, there's a little space with a bed on the, a metal frame on the floor, and there's a metronome just ticking away slowly, and it's called the shoebox. And so that piece is, of course, about solitary confinement and that feeling of being trapped in one single space and not being able to get out. And then upstairs, as you walk upstairs, it is a little bit more like a traditional gallery setting upstairs. There is paintings by Margot Pelletier, who was a political prisoner in the 1980s in Rikers Island, and they're giant colorful paintings, and there's images. Two different formerly incarcerated people have their work upstairs. One is Robert Hayden, who is a painter who lives here in Greene County, and he was incarcerated for about 17 years in different places all over New York State, and he did paintings of his heroes, including Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass and Rosa Parks, and he also has scenes of Catskill, so a beautiful upstate village, which is where he's landed, and he's just sort of doing an homage to the kind of life he'd like to recreate for himself on the outside, being reconnected with his family and having new neighbors and being outside of the hustle and bustle of the city, which is where he grew up.
Prison Voices Project co-producer interviewed Robert Hayden, one of the artists in the show.
Well, my name is Robert Hayden. I'm 68 years old. I was born 7/3/47. And my art came about when I went to prison for the first time in 1973. And I was laying on my bed in prison, like up on the third tier. And the noise in the block that had like six different tiers, you know, three on one side and three on the other side, which had about 42 cells in it. The noise was horrendous when guys are trying to talk to guys in one cell back to 42 cells. And I tried to sleep the bit away. And that was giving me sores, bed sores. And just one day I just rolled off the bed and fell to my knees and started crying. And I asked the Lord, I said, please give me something to do to keep my mind off of this noise and to be able to take care of my family in some kind of way. And I don't know how long I stayed down there on my knees, but I was crying like crazy. But I wasn't crying too loud because, you know, I couldn't let the guys hear me. And then I got up and I sat on my bed and I was drying my eyes and I had a piece of cardboard over, leaning against the wall, and my wife's picture was on my desk, and she was holding a bouquet of flowers. Mm. And I just took a pencil and started sketching it. And I knew an artist down, the Tia, I think he was like in 42 cell, I was like in 16 cell. And he came by my cell when we locked up that morning, and I stopped him. I said, "Hey, man," I said, "you know, what are you thinking?" I held it up to him, and he said, "Wow, man, I didn't know you was an artist." I said, "I didn't know I was an artist either." And he said, "Wait a minute." And he went back to his cell and got a big box, cardboard box, full of pastels. And he told me, he said, "Look, man, look, go down to the wood shop, make yourself a stretcher, tear the sheet off of your bed, and tack it to it. Draw that picture out in the pencil form and color it in with the pastels." And from that day on, after a lot of people saw it, officers, correction officers, civilians, and inmates was coming to me to get portraits done.
Wow.
I was sending it home to my money.
Wow.
Well, you know, with the my fellow inmates, they were buying, you know, commissary and giving it to me. I would just give them a list and they would give it to the commissary.
Wow.
But that's, to me, it was answer to a prayer.
Mm.
It blew my mind. My kind of like terror in my life started off with me being like 7, 8 years old and looking at the Jim Crow that was happening on the TV. You know, and seeing the three girls that got bombed in the church in Alabama, and the civil rights workers getting murdered, and the buses being set on fire that the people was in that was, you know, against the Jim Crow thing, and seeing all of the literature that was in our neighborhoods where white people were standing up under a tree where two black men was hanging from it, and they was posing and smiling for it, and this is, so
I had, like, they had been lynched.
Yeah, that was loaded into our neighborhoods, that literature. It was all over the place.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I guess it was saying, you know, you start that nonsense around here, we're gonna hang you too, you know. But at the age of 8, I just got mad one night, and I left out of my house maybe about 1 o'clock in the morning, and went and I had this thing about being vengeful, vengeance, getting vengeance on white people. And I went down into a white neighborhood, and I did my first burglary. I went to a house, looked in the window, went around the back. The screen door was the only door that was there, but there was a pocketbook on the kitchen table right there. And I took it outside, took the money out of a wallet, put it back, and I took a little red purse too and shoved the money in there. But I took only $10 out. And later on that day, I came back upstairs to my mother, and I said, "Hey, Mom, look what I found." And she said, "Let me see what you got." And she said, and she called my feet. She said, "Jimmy, look what Rob found." They went out and they shopped. Now, we were eating pan bread, flour and water, but then my mother was cooking in a pan, you know, with some jelly, because that's all that was in the house. The first time I went to prison, I set myself up to go there. And the reason why I did that, because one day I was down in the basement and I was dealing drugs, and some girls was bagging up some weed for me on the pool table, and TV was on. And back then in the 60s, you know, you had the TV on, you had the sound turned down, and the record player on, and Marvin Gaye, you know, Temptations, Ball of Confusion, and all of that. That was that was being played back there in those days. You know, it was like activism was going on all over the place. And everybody was taking up, not I can't say everybody, but a lot of people was taking up causes to protest against. And all of a sudden on the TV I see a yard, a prison yard, and guys naked laying down in flat on their face in the rain. And I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? And I turned the record player off, and I turned the TV up, and it was the Attica riot. It was September the 9th, 1971. I'll never forget it. And when I looked at it, because I've always been sensitive to that, the discrimination. And when I looked at it, I started crying. And just before that, I had just started getting into reading the Bible. What happened was I found out, you know, what was going on by looking at it. And then I said to the girls, I told them, I got to go in there. They said, Rob, we ain't got no car to take you to Attica. I said, no, I'm not talking about taking me to Attica in the car. I said, I'm talking about I got to go in there and find out why those guys got killed. Mm-hmm. And they said, man, are you crazy? I said, no, I'm not crazy, man. Hey, you know, everybody else is going, you know, and Joanne Chesmar and all these other people that, you know, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panthers, this is going to be my cause. And I started selling smoke and hash out of a tobacco shop in Hempstead, Long Island, right down the street from the police station. And my uncle at that time, he was the chief of police over Nassau County. And he's gone now, he passed away. But he was my mother's brother, you know. And he was the little brother in the family. And he had called my mother and told her, he said, tell Rob, whatever he's doing, stop doing it because there's an investigation on him. And my mother called me down at the smoke shop. And I said, Will called me up. And he told me to tell you, whatever you're doing, stop doing because there's an investigation on you. And I said, Ma, I can't do that. She said, what are you talking about? I said, I got to go in prison and find out why those guys got killed. She said, are you crazy? What are you talking about? I said, Ma, I got to do it. All right? She said, Rob, Ma, I'm going. I guess it was about 4 months, 4 to 6 months before they came and busted me. I had a garbage bag full of weed coming out of the motel. And I was in the cab, and they pulled me out of the car. And then they reached in and pulled the bag up. And they looked in it and said, oh, we got him now. And the first thing I said, now I'm zooted because I stayed zooted. I stayed high. I said to him, man, well, it's about time. But, you know, then when they got in the car and I started talking so much about, you know, the injustices and everything, two was in the car. They had to get out, and then they put another two in the car. And I'm like, you know, and they were the first time that you saw officers out of uniform and looking like hippies. They had the long hair, the long beard and everything. And I said, man, you guys ain't gonna tell me y'all don't smoke no weed, man. But I ended up getting 7 years for that. I did 4 years on it. I didn't go exactly to Attica. I went to Eastern Correctional Facility in Ellenville area. Mm. And when I went into the prison, there were some of them guys I wanted to kill myself because they were acting stupid. And the biggest thing that I learned in there was most inmates, and there's injustices that happen in there. But the big thing that I noticed was that guys wasn't taking fault for the crimes. Mm. They was pointing fingers and blaming it on, it's the white man, look at that police over there, man. You know, we'd be in a mess hall and they're talking about, look at that police over there, all he does is work. And then I'm at the table, I'm saying, wait a minute, man. I said, how much money are you making? Oh, man, I make like $5 every 2 weeks, man. And I said, you're talking about he's always working, he's taking care of his family, he's doing this and doing that, man. And here we are in here, man, making $5 every 2 weeks. I said, are you crazy? And some of them were adamant about, no, man, look, man, blah, 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 damn. I said, man, well, what about us? We did, I did mine, did you do yours? Well, you know, well, they. And that's what I was in there doing. I was also doing something else that I shouldn't be doing in prison. I was talking to the police. I was talking to the corrections officers. And I kept a good relationship with them, but other inmates were seeing me as snitching. Mm-hmm. And I didn't care. Well, my father was a Golden Gloves champ. He fought what you probably may not know them, but he fought Sugar Ray Robinson and Archie Moore back in his day. And he had put me and my brothers in the ring. And we could pretty much handle ourselves. So when stuff came to me, I just took it. And all you got to do is pick out the biggest guy in there and do him. Everybody else gets the message, but I'm not saying I couldn't be beat, but then I did three more bids after that. All together, I did 32 years on the installment plan.
Your story, I mean, mm-hmm. Is really hard. It's the one that I read, and I'm like, mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. clearly.
Right.
Things that you're saying, but your art is really optimistic and vibrant, mm-hmm. and like mm-hmm. really every single one of them that I see.
Yeah, thank you.
What is the? How did such a hard life produce such vibrant artwork?
I guess from all of the ugliness I've seen, I don't want to produce anything ugly.
Mm.
I want to. Do something that's flower-like, you know, that's loving,
mm.
you know, because like I said, what really happened to me when I seen the white people in the marches,
mm.
that had an impact on my life. There's the vengeance was gone, and then the guilt was there, and then that's where a lot of the drugs came in for me to anesthetize myself with the guilt.
Mm-hmm.
What I've done. As a matter of fact, you know, when I just got out in June of 2013 from doing 17 years, I came out with, I must have gave away about a good 50 of my original paintings. I had a ball in prison. I did. Yeah, because I have a degree in human services, you know, and
which you got in prison?
Yeah, I got it in prison, yeah.
In Clinton?
Yeah, in Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
I was the first one to come out of there with a bachelor's.
So do you see your art as a tool of sort of communicating across racial barriers?
Yeah, we'll see, right now.
Yeah.
Right now, right here.
Yeah.
You know, we're sitting here and we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is beautiful.
Yeah. Well, in closing, can mm-hmm. I, you mentioned that you're a singer.
Mm-hmm.
Can I get you to sing a little bit?
Just a little bit.
Just a little bit.
Okay. Gospel, I sing.
Yeah.
Tell me what more could anyone have done than what Christ did for us at Calvary? And when I think of the beating he took, then my heart is moved to trembling. Like a silent sheep
bled to the slaughter. No way was he turning back. And as his eyes looked to Golgotha, he was determined to pay for what our sins did exact. Oh, 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 greater love has no one than this, than one lays their life down for a friend. Oh, but Jesus, he exceeded them all when he laid down his life for a people full of strife who wanted nothing to do with him.
Curator Molly Stinchfield continues to talk about the rest of the exhibit, Beyond the Bars, in Catskill, New York, which this show is devoted to. I'm your co-producer, Alexandra Cox.
And then there's also drawings that Salvatore Puma made while he was in prison. He was also incarcerated in six different prisons in New York State. And he managed to keep the drawings that he made while he was in prison. Mm-hmm. So he has, which is very rare because sometimes they get confiscated. And so he has all the different drawings that he made, letters that he wrote to his wife, letters that he wrote to his kids that are illustrated with pictures of them and pictures of the children of his friends that he made in prison, all, you know, just anything that a prison guard or a prisoner wanted to remember, he would take that photo and turn it into a drawing so that they could have a beautiful drawing of their kid to look at, or, you know, pictures of their favorite car that they were obsessed with, or, you know, and actual drawings of the inside of prisons, which is the most shocking and rare information that I've seen, because of course nobody, you're not allowed to make drawings of certainly cell layouts or yard layouts, anything like that is considered contraband. So it's really rare. It's a really rare collection that he has, and he was able to take it out of the prison. And now he's an iron worker in Catskill. He's a business owner, and he's done a lot of the different projects in Catskill and the rest of Greene County and all the way down to New York City, the new Yankee Stadium he worked on. So he's doing really well, which is great.
Cedric Fulton, I'm the deputy director of the Staley B. Keith Social Justice Center in Hudson, New York.
And can you, a lot of our listeners are inside, so they can't see the work itself. So if you could talk a little bit about what you're looking at, that would be great.
Well, first of all, it was done by a wonderful 17-year-old black woman that has gone through so much. And this, the work that she's depicting is, being an independent black woman and what it means to be an independent black woman, and then what's the struggles. What I'm seeing is them, you know, giving up, you know, with their hands raised for black women dressed in orange, you know, in front of a wire fence, looked like a prison. And with their hands up, it's like they're, you know, peacefully giving up, you know, resistance. And then you go on to progress on to, you know, them being in chains, where there's no gray area. It's black and white. They're in chains. You know, you see the struggle in their face. And then the progression on to them standing up for themselves and saying that we're taking back our womanhood, you know, as independent black women, you know. And then the last picture really speaking to that strong, independent black woman, you know, sans the chains and the background. But, you know, just seeing this, I'm so proud of Jasmine, you know, from her putting her passion and drive into this work, you know, really wanting to, like we told all the students in the Social Justice Leadership Academy, that they were going to do a project, you know, and you can pick your own project. And this is how she chose to express herself. And it spoke volumes. I sat back and watched people's reaction to it, which is phenomenal to me. I can't wait to go back and express that to her.
And what is the Social Justice Leadership Academy?
The Social Justice Leadership Academy is a five-week summer program of
created by Kites Nest, the Stanley B. Keefe Social Justice Center, and the Watershed. And what we came up with, we had children from the age of 18 all the way down to 11. And they were learning about, you know, racial injustice, gender roles, thinking outside the box. They were taking on all the struggles of society and learning the inception, learning how, you know, where that began, the genesis of that, and where do they want to jump on board and where would they want to take it? How do they want to express themselves or be a part of you know, bringing it back, being an agent of change? And the turnout was amazing. You know.
How many students participated?
We had 18 students. We had some paid students that were between the ages of 15 to 18, and they came on as mentors. They came on as facilitators, co-facilitators. And then we had the rest of the students that came in, the 11 to the 14-year-olds that came in. And surprisingly, a lot of 11 to 14-year-olds took leadership. Like, they took the ball and ran with it. And one of them was our keynote speaker at our last.
Wow.
You know, so that was amazing to see something like that and see the growth from the beginning, you know, and see how in the beginning they were all, you know, spaced out. They were all just 18 individuals. And then how at the end of 5 weeks they were a unit. They cared about each other. And even right now, this, you know, our last event was August 6th, I believe. And even right now, just keeping on top of each other, you know, and trying to keep those connections is a great thing.
Next up, the spoken word performance by Jasmine Wise, one of the artists featured in the show and a participant in the Stanley B. Keith Social Justice Project.
They hold us back, but we still wear our crown. They beat us down, but we still wear our crown. They take advantage, but we still wear our crown. But if we fight back, they can't hold us down.
It's minority members, and I think it's pretty shocking, and I think social media is changing the way we are able to learn about it, which I think is great.
It occurs much more than we know. A lot of times the media only picks up certain stories, but it's happening every day all over the world. It's obviously a huge injustice to anyone it happens to. Just in terms of violence and physicality, a lot of times I feel women are silenced in this process, where sometimes men have the ability to really fight back physically, and women are often, they don't have the same physical strength in that way.
If your skin was darker, how would you think life would be?
I think it would be very difficult. I think I get the benefit of the doubt in a lot of situations.
I'm very aware of my privilege as a white person, as a white woman. And I think that, and I wish that more white people would recognize that they're born with a privilege.
A gut reaction, you know, as a father, you know, a husband, is to want to go and do harm to them. That's the gut reaction. But, you know, I know that that would not get me where I would like to be as far as serving justice. I fall right into their hands at that point. But I would try my best to go through the proper channels, get a lawyer, and see if justice can be served that way.
I think it's horrible what's happened, and the news headlines I've seen are just awful, and I hope that change happens.
Police brutality is disturbing against anybody, not just women.
They hold us back, but we still wear our crown. They beat us down, but we still wear our crown. They take advantage, but we still wear our crown. But if we fight back, they can't hold us down.
This is the Prison Voices Project on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Alexandra Cox, one of the co-producers of the Prison Voices Project. Finally, I had an opportunity to interview Edgar Behrens, who made the film Prison Terminal. Edgar came to screen the film at SUNY New Paltz as part of the Beyond the Bars exhibit programming.
My name's Edgar Behrens. I'm an independent film director. I'm currently a media specialist at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Jane Addams College of Social Work. And my films usually focus on the criminal justice system here in the United States. My most recent project was Prison Terminal, The Last Days of Private Jack Hall, which is a 40-minute short documentary that basically is about prison hospice, a program that is desperately needed in our prison system because commutation or medical parole are things that are not usually granted in time for a terminally ill prisoner. So the prison hospice program that I focused on in my film was and still is running at the Iowa State Penitentiary, which is a maximum security penitentiary. And that basically, the film outlines what it is to have a prison hospice program run by prisoners who are well-trained in hospice care, and what the benefits are for not only the prisoner who is terminally ill, but also for the prisoners who have a hand in assisting the person going through the passing process.
And what is hospice, for our listeners who don't know?
Well, hospice is a program that usually when your doctor basically says that you have 6 months to live, and if you want hospice or palliative care, you can decide to go with that. And hospice basically is for your last 6 months of life, and it is a difficult time, obviously, but you basically realize that your quality of life is much more important than the quantity left. So you decide to go into hospice, and that basically is care, round-the-clock care for, you know, hopefully pain management and ultimately a dignified death, surrounded by family, loved ones, friends. Now, on the outside, that is fairly common, although I have to say a lot of people don't even know that hospice is available until it's too late here out in the community. But in prison, this is something that's usually not available. So the fact that this prison in Iowa has a hospice program and that it's manned by prisoners is something very unique. And there's only 20 programs like that in the country right now.
And as I understand it, you yourself have trained to be a hospice worker. Could you describe some of the skills and kind of qualities that are needed to be a hospice worker?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. In order to prepare myself for this film, for making the film, I went through a 14-week hospice training here in the community. I live in Aurora, Illinois, so there is a community hospice not very far from here. And once you sign up as a volunteer, they put you through a 14-week training course. And basically, it teaches you to not only to be compassionate, hopefully you're coming to the table being compassionate already, but it kind of teaches you to be sensitive to the person who's passing away and their needs. And also not only for the for the patient who is passing away, but also to their family members. Hospice is a holistic program, so it not only trains you to be compassionate to the person who's terminally ill, but it also makes you realize that the fact that this person is passing away, the family is also affected by this. So you become very well-tuned in how to help the family go through this the dying process of their loved one. So, I mean, it's never like you never do any medical at all, meds or anything. It's basically comfort care. So you might be there to write a letter to a loved one that won't have the chance to see the loved one pass away, or so you do a lot of just comfort care where you're holding hands and you're listening to stories. And I think the biggest element that is crucial to be a hospice volunteer is patience, compassion, and the ability to just simply listen, and listen with curiosity and with like, I don't know, a true heart, because, you know, this is somebody's time, last, you know, days, weeks, months on Earth, and, you know, the best thing they can have is someone to talk to, and someone who's listening, who's an active listener, and who's curious.
Your film is about the final days of this man in this prison in Iowa, but it also features the men who are in prison who are trained to be hospice workers themselves. What do you think struck you the most about those men in their capacity to care for this man?
You know, these guys, a lot of them have been in there for, you know, 20 plus years. And for the first time in this prison, and maybe even in their lives, they're giving they're given the opportunity to be loving and compassionate, and to really connect with another soul. Something that is usually not, you know, either condoned or allowed in prison. So here these guys who are hardened. I mean, let's face it, they're in for murder and various other crimes. They're hardened criminals, but they have become rehabilitated, and this process for them to be hospice volunteers is absolutely redemptive too, because this for the first time is something that they can do, that they are actually somebody different. You know, they're not what people expect them to be, and they can rise to this situation and absolutely be there for another human being. And you know, this also gives them a perspective of like how precious life is, and perhaps on their crime and how they probably sent a family into a tailspin when they committed their crime. So it was an unbelievable opportunity to be with these guys. They're absolute professionals. They are also trained in, you know, orderly care. So they do, they're integrated in the daily infirmary life as well. So, and they help the nurses immeasurably on a daily basis there. So these guys are, absolute professionals, and when it comes to hospice care, they you know, they are pretty amazing, and they realize that this is something that is very rare behind the walls, and they really do want to hold on to this program.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say I'm loud, say I'm clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.